together issues very thoughtfully over many years. Rosalind Barnett is a senior scientist in Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis and also a clinician. And they are going to go first. And they have written a book that in part takes on a lot of the pseudoscience about gender in this country. So I'll hand it over to you, Kara.
Do I need to go to the mic?
I think you just stay there.
Oh, okay. Can everybody hear me? Okay, good. I'll try to talk loud too. We were been very interested in gender issues for a lot of years, and we also noticed that we seem to be slipping backwards. And one of the things that seemed to be happening is we're going back into pink and blue mode. You go into any store now, and you'll see a pink aisle and a blue aisle. And we're also seeing more ideas of the pink classroom and the blue classroom. And the argument is that boys' brains and girls' brains are so different, they have to be educated very, very differently. Well, what we discovered when we were looking at the latest research is that, in fact, the best peer-reviewed research says the brains of girls and boys are absolutely trivial. There's no reason to set up in pink and blue classrooms. What happens in those cases is that half the kids get left out because there's much more overlap. You know, boys and girls are more like each other than not, so the brain stuff doesn't work. And we also have this idea, it's you know, touted by bestsellers like Michael Gurian, who wrote The Wonder of Boys, that girls don't have the right brain structures to do math. And alas, some of that was picked up by Larry Summers when he made that famous comment about girls inherently don't have the right stuff to do math. He apologized, by the way, but this idea it continues, and what we see now is that girls are making up the gap very quickly. There are no brain structure differences in girls that make them unable to do high-level math and science. It's just not true. And it's also not true that boys are inherently nonverbal, that we got to dumb down reading for them. We're seeing classrooms where boys are given, they're supposed to watch videos instead of reading. And in fact, there's only a trivial difference in verbal abilities between boys and girls. So we worry that boys are starting to get dumbed down and moved away from careers as writers, journalists, speakers, and everything else that requires verbal abilities.
Hey, I'm Rosalind Barnett, and Carol and I have written this, our fifth book together, so we have a long track record of doing it. One of the other things that we've learned in doing the work on this book is that issues about gender stereotyping start having their effect very early on. Parents, just like the rest of us, are awash in notions about what's appropriate for girls and boys. In some of the recent research with kids very young, you find dramatic differences. I'll tell you one study which we are very intrigued with. This is a study of toddlers and their mothers. And first, the mothers were in a room, carpeted room, with ramps that had adjustable angles. And the researchers asked them to adjust the ramp to the angle they thought their children would be comfortable going down. And they did all that, recorded it. And then they brought the babies in and watched what the kids, in fact, did. Well, it won't be a surprise to some of you, I don't think, that mothers thought their boys would be much more daring, so put the angle much more steep. But for girls, they thought the girls would be... you know, a little more vulnerable and they needed more protection, so they adjusted the angle to be less steep, turned the kids loose, and if anything, the girls took on more daring angles. And the differences weren't dramatic, but the important thing was that the mothers had way underestimated their daughters' abilities. So if you generalize that a bit, if mothers and fathers protect their daughters and don't provide them with opportunities to challenge their motor abilities, then that's going to have a cascading effect on what kinds of experiences boys and girls have in the world. The other thing that comes through in a lot of what's written now is that girls are the caring gender. Somehow or other, if you watch little babies operate and toddlers, that both boys and girls are very, very caring of one another. They're altruistic. When someone's hurt, they want to comfort them. And somehow, over a short period of time, that behavior is labeled as feminine. So boys' caring nature becomes problematic. You know, he's too soft, he's too girly. And I think it's a loss to boys, it's a loss to all of us, to have that kind of behavior, which is so human, done distorted in this kind of way. But you do see that boys become very attentive to pets, so it's not that they can't care, but caring to others somehow is labeled as a non-masculine thing, which is obviously a terrible problem. And also, not only do parents' stereotypes start affecting their kids early on, kids also start, by age two, they already have a primitive understanding of what's male and female and what behaviors go with male and female. And some of the studies are very intriguing. We discuss them in the book. But that parents, the kids, watching their parents, becoming aware of their environment, are starting at a very early age to get these notions of, well, this is not a girl thing or a boy thing. And what happens with early learning like that, it's very, very deep learning. It starts, and then what we know from a lot of work in social science, that people start to, kids as well as older kids, selectively perceive the environment so that their beliefs are affirmed. So you end up with very deep learning. Now let's say their kids are older and they start learning, well, no, that's not true, girls can do these things. But if you really believe inside a deep level that girls can't, then new learning is very hard. It doesn't always take hold. So
I might add here, there's a great study that some people dreamed up, because we now say, of course, boys go for the building blocks and the coasters and guns that's hardwired, and the girls go for the dolls and the tea set. So what these people did is they took a gun and they painted it purple, and the holster, they put little rhinestones on the sparkly rhinestones on the gun, and they took this tea set and they made it all cami and it had sharp angles and everything, and they asked five-year-olds, which is the boy toy and which is the girl toy? And to a child, they all said, oh, the sparkly gun, that's for girls, and the tea set with the cami, that's for boys. So the power of packaging is enormous. It's not that somehow there are these deep brain structures that make boys go for toys or girls.
Great. Thank you. Let me quickly introduce Niobe Wei, who is a psychology professor at New York University and one of the leading experts on adolescence in the country. And I just also want to say that we've had men writing about women for a long time. And some novelists and playwrights like Shakespeare and Tolstoy, I think, have been actually wonderfully perceptive about women. Freud, not so much. Much thinner, shorter literature of women who are writing about boys and men. And I think this is a very important literature, and that Niobe has really spent a lot of time actually listening to boys and young men. So I'm delighted.
I'm going to go up there.
Okay.
I'm going to go up here because it's easier. I want to read from my book. I'm going to read four pages that summarizes the book. The book is based on 20 years of research with boys. I've been listening to teenage boys for that long. I also have my own boy. Okay, so I'm just going to read, and then hopefully we'll engage in a dialogue. And I also want to talk about, hopefully, how this relates to girls, too. It is the middle of June, and the New York City heat is on full blast, making it even hotter in the empty high school classroom where 15-year-old Justin and his interviewer, Jose, sit in the late afternoon. Justin, whose mother is Puerto Rican and whose father is Irish and Italian-American, is being interviewed for my school-based research project on boys' social and emotional development. There is neither an air conditioner nor a fan in the classroom, so Justin, in his baggy jeans and t-shirt, pulls out a notebook from his backpack and starts to fan himself as he listens to Jose begin the interview protocol. The meeting is the second of four annual interviews. The first set of questions is about Justin's friends in general. He responds by discussing his network of peers, and then turning to the topic of close friendships, he says, quote, "My best friend and I love each other. That's it. You have this thing that is so deep, it's within you. You can't explain it. It's just a thing that you know that person is that person. And that is all that should be important in our friendship. I guess in life, sometimes two people can really, really understand each other and really have a trust, respect, and love for each other. It just happens. It's human nature." Unquote. Listening to boys, particularly those in early and middle adolescence, speak about their male friendships is like reading an old-fashioned romance novel in which the female protagonist is describing her passionate feelings for her man. At the edge of manhood, when pressures to conform to gender expectations intensify, boys speak about their male friends with abandon, referring to them as people whom they love, and to their feelings as, to put it in Justin's word, this thing that is deep, so deep it's within you, you can't explain it. They talk in great detail and with tremendous affect about their best friends, with whom they share their deepest secrets, and without whom they would, according to 15-year-old Malcolm, feel lost. Boys also underscore how important the sharing of thoughts and feelings in their friendships are for their psychological well-being. George, at 16-year-old, says that his close friends are important because, quote, "I mean, if you just have your mother and your father or your parents to talk to, then you're just going to have all these ideas bottled up, and you're just going to go wacko because you can't express yourself even more, unquote. Chen says at 15 years old that he needs a close friend so, quote, you have someone to talk to. Like you have problems with something, you go to talk to him. You know, if you have it all if you keep all the stuff to yourself, you go crazy, try to take it out on somebody else. Kai says bluntly at the age of 14, you need a friend or else you'd be depressed. You won't be happy. You'd try to kill yourself because then you'd be all alone and no one to talk to, unquote. Set against a culture that perceives boys and men to be activity-oriented, emotionally illiterate, and interested only in independence, these responses seem shocking. The image of the lone cowboy, the cultural icon of masculinity, and the symbol of independence and thus of maturity in the West, suggests that what boys want and need most are opportunities for competition and autonomy. Yet the vast majority of the hundreds of boys whom my research team and I have interviewed from early to late adolescence suggest that their closest friendships share the plot of love story more than the plot of The Lord of the Flies. Boys valued their male friendships greatly and saw them as an essential component to their health, not because their friends were worthy opponents in the competition for manhood, but because they were able to share their thoughts and feelings, their deepest secrets with these friends. Okay, I'm gonna read part two of the story, okay? A page and a half more. This is now listening to boys in late adolescence. So that was early and middle adolescence. This is late adolescence, okay? This is a different story. A simple question asked by an interviewer provokes a simple response that reveals everything about friendships among boys during late adolescence. The question asked of each boy in my research is, how have your friendships changed since you were a freshman in high school? The responses of three boys in their senior year are, quote, I don't know, maybe not a lot, but I guess that best friends become close friends. So that's basically the only thing that's changed. It's like best friends become close friends become general friends, and general friends become acquaintances. So that's just, if there's a distance, whether it's, I don't know, natural or whatever, you can say that, but it just happens that way, unquote. Another boy says, and this happens to be my favorite quote. You do have favorite quotes in this work, okay. Like my friendship with my best friend is fading, but I'm saying it's still there, but, so I mean it's still there because we still do stuff together, but only once in a while. It's sad because he only lives one block away from me and I get to do stuff with him less than I get to do stuff with people who are way further. So I'm like, yo, it's like a DJ, used his crossfader and started fading it slowly and slowly. And now I'm like halfway through the crossfade, unquote. Late adolescence for the boys in my studies is a time of disconnection and loneliness. Rather than simply being a period of progress, as scholars of human development emphasize, adolescence for these boys is also a period of profound loss. At the age of 16 or 17, as their bodies are almost full grown, and their minds are increasingly attuned to cultural messages about manhood and maturity, boys begin to distance themselves from the relationships they hold most dear, their closest male friendships. They became more distrustful and less willing to be close with their male friendships, and believe, and this is critical, and believe that such behavior and even their emotional acuity put them at risk of being labeled girly, immature, or gay. Thus, rather than focusing on who they are, they become obsessed with who they are not. They are not girls and not children, and not, in the case of heterosexual boys, are they gay. In response to a cultural context that links intimacy in male friendships with emotional sensitivity, with a sex and a sexuality, the boys matured into men who are autonomous, emotionally stoic, and isolated. The ages of 16 to 19, however, are not only a period of disconnection for my boys, it is also the period in which the suicide rate for boys in the United States rises dramatically and becomes 5 times the rate for girls. Just as boys during early and middle adolescence predicted, not having friends to share their deepest secrets makes them go, quote unquote, wacko. Thank you.
Thank you. We got it.
Great. Well, let me start with a question for Niobe, and we are going to get to girls, I promise. I know you want to do that.
I'll always look at the girls.
Yeah. But I also encourage you all to, if you have questions for each other, to jump in. So there's much of what you're saying here that really rings true for me, that intimacy is evaporating as boys get older in high school and college, but I'm also very aware that in college there are fraternities, there are young men who are going to war, there are sports where men feel very intense bonds in one way. And they're not as articulate about their intimacy or their vulnerabilities as they are in middle school, but it's a form of intimacy, I think. But I'm interested in what you think about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a, it's a complicated thing because at some level there's a, people will oftentimes tell me, so among college-age boys, for example, there was actually, this is old-fashioned by now, but there was something called bromance. And so people were saying, right, so people were saying that, you know, boys aren't having a problem anymore with close friendships because there's bromance going on. And bromance means essentially an intimate relationship between two boys that's like a romance, but it's between brothers. So the reality, though, is if you look at those sort of what's called bromance relationships oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, is that it's the sort of the wolf in sheep's clothing. So that it's still the same old sort of connecting around, going out and getting wasted, picking up women, being crazy, being wild and crazy, which I'm not making a judgment here or there. I'm saying that's not the intimacy I'm talking about. The intimacy that the boys are talking about is really about being able to be vulnerable, being able to express feelings about things they're worrying about, things they're concerned about. Oftentimes it relates to their parents, things they're worried about at home. That's the kind of intimacy that the boys are wanting and then are missing as they get older. So the question I would ask, to throw back a question, is in sort of what we don't know yet is in the situations, right, of fraternities or in how much of those sort of real intimate friendships are going on, it's unclear. Because, you know, explicitly listening to college-age boys, oftentimes it looks like it is when it's not.
Just to bring it down to young kids, there's been a fair bit of research at the kinds of communication parents have with their little boys and girls. And early on, it turns out that with respect to girls, there's a lot more interaction, eliciting feelings. How are you like to play? The vine is funny, isn't it?
You're sort of going in and out. I think you're fine.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yep.
Asking, you know, how is your doll today? Or how are you feeling? Or what's on your mind? That kind of interaction. With boys, not so much. With boys, parents tend to give orders. Come here, go there, sit down, play with this. So very early on, you get a different kind of dialogue going on that encourages, almost as if, you know, where's the chicken and the egg, but if parents think that girls have more emotional connection or like emotional connection, they're apt to talk to them in a way that elicits that kind of behavior. If parents think that boys are more, you know, objective, action-oriented, they're less likely to engage them in conversations that elicit emotional responses. So you get this bifurcation of vocabulary and experience and caring behavior starting very young. And I think this is where the notion that parents, like all of us, are filled with these ideas. And it's time for parents, if they're interested, to say, why am I doing that? To notice their own behavior and say, where is that coming from?
And you know, one thing that's very interesting, there's a guy named Leonard Sachs who writes a book, Why Gender Matters, who is so popular that last year he gave like 60 lectures to big
Major.
Lectures to teachers and students and educators. And he says that for boys reading, you should not deal at all with the character's emotions. You should only deal with what they do. So you should put emotions off limits for boys when talk about reading because they can't handle it. And you should only deal with these sort of action kind of things. So you, again, it's that cultural message you mentioned, Rick, that that the boys are getting, and that Niobe talked about, that the boys are getting that emotions aren't for them, action is for them.
And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, and there's another body of literature that picks up on rough and tumble play, which used to be thought that was one of the few consistent gender differences in little kids, that boys engage in rough and tumble play and girls don't. But if you look at it more closely, some people think that rough and tumble play among boys is actually an expression of closeness. It's one of the few approved physical contacts boys can have with one another. It's a roughhouse with them. And if you constrain boys' behavior early on, then you channel it into behaviors that you think are okay. So you end up with an observed difference. Well, girls don't do rough and tumble play, and boys do. And maybe hypothesize it has to do with hormones or genes, when it could in fact be that the society is already labeling other kinds of touching close behavior in boys, little boys, as off limits. But rough and tumble play is okay.
Great. Let me ask a question to you guys. So in the book, you make the claim that boys contrary to popular belief, girls are, levels of aggression are in fact comparable to boys. And also that boy, contrary to popular belief, boys' level of interpersonal skill is comparable to girls, and boys' empathy is comparable to girls. But my question is about sort of form. Like, you know, the form of girls' aggression is quite different than the form of boys' aggression. The form of boys' empathy, I think, is quite different than the form of girls' empathy. Do you think that has a two questions. Do you think that has a biological basis? And the second question is, what does that mean for educators and people? If you agree with me, what does that mean for educators and people?
Let me take a whack at that, because I'm not in the care. With respect to aggression, for a long time, the research on aggression in kids looked at behavior during recess, what they coded was physical aggression. And clearly, boys are more aggressive than girls. So this is looking at observable behavior, and they conclude, well, yes, of course, boys are more aggressive. Then along came some Scandinavian researchers, much more sophisticated, said, well, there are other kinds of aggression besides relational aggression, people calling names to each other or excluding people, and there's indirect aggression. And when you tally those kinds of aggressions up, first of all, the absolute level, if you count all of them, girls and boys are equally aggressive, but the form is very different, and the form of all our behaviors is completely related to the social sanctions. So girls are sanctioned for being physically aggressive, but they're not so sanctioned for being verbally aggressive, and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, I also just want to add, I think that the form of empathy and sensitivity, if you listen to the boys, oftentimes people, when they listen to the boys, but they don't know it's a boy, they'll say, those are girls talking. And so that, in and of itself, that people think the boys, quotes, are girls talking, mm-hmm. suggests that the ways in which they're having relationships is actually, the form is very similar, and the way they talk about them is very similar. And by the way, also the betrayal that happens between boys and their sensitivity to betrayal, and they're worried about being betrayed, someone, their best friend telling their secret to somebody else, consumes boys. I was a high school counselor many, many years ago, and one of the things I was most struck with is the amount of time boys talked about concerns about being betrayed, talking about their close friendship. They basically, in our culture, they sounded like girls. I claim they sound like humans. That's what we do as humans. We talk about relationships. We talk about our emotions. And so the boys, in terms of form, I would say, is very, very similar in the social emotional domain as girls.
One of the points your question raises, and we do a lot in the book with this, is that two levels of analysis. If you just look at observed behavior, you'll say, oh, well, boys and girls are very different. Men and women are very different. And of course, that's true. But the question is, how do you understand that observed difference? Do you understand it to be a function of innate differences, kind of hardwired differences? Or do you understand that to be a channeling of natural abilities or tendencies that are similar? And there's overwhelming evidence to suggest that the form, the observable form of behavior is completely socially dictated. But it belies the fact that underneath that you have enormous similarities between the genders.
But I just want to reinforce that oftentimes we buy into the fact because of our culture that the form is different. And I think what I've most learned, right, from listening about the social emotional domain is in fact the form's not so different. So absolutely you're right that the form is socially right. But the question is how much we, even when it's right in front of our faces, we continue to say that the form is different. When the boys are talking the same way as the girls, they're wanting the same way, and we continue to say the form is different, and at some point the boys are asking us to stop doing it.
Well, I think it's also true that it's socially, the context is important, at least in the areas that I'm aware of. If males are being observed, as opposed to in an experimental situation or an interview situation, their behavior is dictated by what they think the stereotype for their gender should be. Right. So if you look at empathic behavior, if a male in a social situation, they're much less likely to show empathy than in a situation where they're not so exposed.
And you know, one thing that's really interesting, Howard Gardner at Harvard says that, you know, kids up to about the age of 5, they really follow their own curiosity, they're open to learning all sorts of things about the world. And then when they get to be about school age, all of a sudden they realize that adults have lots of things that they want them to do. And they develop this overwhelming urge to please adults. And so they start getting channeled into behavior that they know the adults are gonna like. For example, there was one study where boys were given, there was a tea set and building blocks. And when the boys just didn't play with anything, they played with the tea set just as much as with the building blocks. But when they brought in fathers, and particularly fathers who might not like their boys doing this kind of activity, not one kid went to play with the building blocks. So kids learn very, very early what's appropriate, and they really want to please adults.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at some level, this is to enhance what they're saying, but to really repeat something, which is that the most remarkable thing in doing this research, I've been doing this research since the late 80s, the most remarkable thing is that the intimacy in boys' friendships have been written about for over 100 years. There was a study in 1904 talking about how intimacy, sharing secrets between boys, is particularly prevalent among boys. This was a study of thousands of kids in Illinois in 1904. And yet, right, we have through the entire century people talking about this, writing about this, and yet we, at the beginning of the 21st century, we are at a place where we remain to say, girls want intimacy in their friendships, boys don't. They have activity-oriented friendships. Mm-hmm. They don't care about intimacy. That's a girl thing. The question is that I want to ask of the world, right, is why? Why can't we hear that? Why can't we see it? Why are we not willing as adults to see what boys know, what's the hand in front of their face? Why are we not able to say, this is what boys are like? They're actually deeply social, emotional. They're incredibly emotionally articulate. These stories that I get from boys is blows your mind. They're so incredibly nuanced, understanding relationships, how relationships work. And then they grow up, and guess what happens? You start to literally see the emotional language fall out of their stories. They start to become, I don't know, whatever, you know, I don't care. And then you'll hear occasionally this sort of little voice in there when they're 18, I miss him. I wouldn't mind having that friendship. You know, the little voice of desire that you hear. But so you hear the language shift. So this is not something, it can't be, you know, biological, because they have it. They have it all throughout, you know, childhood and into adolescence, and then you begin to see them losing it.
I think one of the things that what you said illustrates very nicely is what people call confirmation bias. So let's say the parents or adults around children see boys being intimate and sharing, but it doesn't conform with their stereotype.
That's right.
And they discount it. We end up all of us holding on to information that meets our or fits with our expectations and discarding or minimizing anything else. So you have people look at something right in front of them and not see it because it doesn't fit with their picture of how the world works.
That's right.
Which is how these things are very insidious, and it's very hard to shake them off. Parents of people who are very interested in these notions and are well-informed still operate in a stereotype way, because this is part of the fabric. It's very hard to shake these things loose.
Well, you look at the culture of last summer's movies. Basically, you have superhero guys who bash people, and if they have friendships with other guys, it's they bash people together. Or, you know, or you have this sort of buddy comedy where they go out, tell fart jokes, you know, get drunk, you know, go crazy. And,
these are my favorite movies.
Probably. Yeah, yeah. and they're fun. And now we've got Bridesmaids where the girls are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But there's no, you know, there's really no. Tell me a movie that you've seen lately about boys that has real emotion. I'm sure there may be some in these films, but I don't see any major Hollywood films.
Well, I guess this is part of the question I was asking, and I think you all agree about this. But now, if I'm understanding your argument, it's that there is this period of time in middle school where boys sound very much like girls.
Yeah.
The form is very much the same, but that evaporates over time, right? So the form is quite different.
Well, we suck it out of them.
We suck it out of them.
So
the
so
there may be forms of intimacy in the fart jokes or whatever, but it's a different kind of intimacy, right? And I think you think it's not quite.
Okay, yeah, but the thing is I don't want to get caught up in saying it's a different form of intimacy, because that's not acknowledging the high level of, you know, the suicide rate among boys, the college students after, by now I've taught, you know, hundreds and hundreds of college students, college student men who come to me saying, you're telling my story, tears in their eyes. I always have men in my classroom crying by the end of the class. You know, it touches something that's very, very deep and profound. I have men from 20 to 75 who've written me emails, letters, et cetera, saying, you're telling my story.
and nobody's talking about it.
I think that's going on, too.
Right, so there's a way in which I don't want to reframe it and say, well, they just have a different type of intimacy as adults. No, they're not having the intimate kind of relationships they're seeking. And obviously there's variability, which I know you want to ask about. There's obviously variability, but there's a way in which I don't want to cover it over by saying, well, it's just a different form of intimacy. It's not the intimacy that boys are seeking, is the bottom line.
Okay. Just in the interest of going on, because I have another question for you. I know you wanted to talk about girls, Naomi, so I wanted to give you a chance to do that, and then I have a question for you guys.
Okay. Well, I just think that it's important to think. I was having a conversation with our poet last night about the relevance for girls, and any topic about boys, as with girls, is relevant for girls, right? Because boys and girls have relationships. Mothers raise boys, right? I mean, you know, the whole notion that boy research is only relevant for boys is this strange thing we do in our culture that somehow doesn't recognize that we actually interact together. So one of the things I find with girls is that girls often, and guess what? We all know this as women, by the way. It's not just boys who are and men who are reinforcing the sort of man box or the stereotypic manhood. It's girls and women, right? So it's not just that. So we think as girls and women, wives, as girlfriends, as that somehow boys, right, are less. They want intimacy less. Those friendships are just a competition for me with me. They're not something that actually helps me have a good relationship with my husband. So we see it. We reinforce this notion, if you're too soft, you're not manly. We want to, right, we want you to man up, and we also want you to be sensitive, but not too sensitive. So there's a whole ways in which women and girls and women reinforce this. And the other thing I would simply say, and then I'll finish, is that the whole notion of wanting relationships, wanting close relationships, is a boy and girl thing. It's a human thing. And until we recognize that it's a fundamentally human thing, we are all seeking close relationships. We all want to have them. That it makes us thrive. The research has shown that for 50 years now, that it makes us, we live longer lives. We have fewer colds. We have fewer flus. Our mental health is better. Everything, all the outcomes, academics, is related to it. So we all know that having these quality relationships is fundamental to our health and well-being, and that is relevant to boys and girls. That's a human thing.
Well, one of the things I think that we see with girls, I think there's a lot of backlash coming back. We're seeing the idea of the end of men, that girls are, you know, taking over everything. We've got to stop this. It's time that we stop paying attention to girls because it's really boys who are in trouble. And there's a cover article on The Atlantic that said that, oh, see, girls are now going to move into all the things, the jobs that lead to the top jobs, because there are more of them in college. Mm-hmm. And the researcher went to interview these teenage girls in the Midwest somewhere, and one girl said, well, when I grow up, I'm going to be a surgeon, and I'm going to be the head of the household, and my husband is going to take care of the kids. And the writer said, this is data. This is how it's going to be. And I said to this kid, good luck, kid. You know, I hope you get this. But, you know, what we see is the Sloan Foundation had a study that shows that the progress girls are making in college is not holding in the workforce. That by 5 years after graduating from college, girls have gone down. By 10 years after graduating colleges, girls have sunk twice as much. So just the idea that girls are doing very well in college doesn't mean the end of men, or that we don't really need to worry about girls.
Let me see if I can squeeze in actually two questions for you guys, and then we want to open it up to your questions or thoughts. One question is, you have a very compelling last chapter about the media and the saturation of media images that sexualize girls and also caricature cartoon boys. So this is a big, tough question, I know, but like, what are we going to do about this? I mean, what are we going to do to counteract, and people in different roles, as parents, as educators, as citizens, because I certainly agree with you that it's a very troubling problem.
I mean, the obvious thing to say is, you know, limit your kids' exposure, but that's very difficult to do. I don't know what individuals can do besides tuning that out. Now, also, I mean, holding media to account, I think it's really appalling. I have made this point, and though not to any great effect, when stories are written about the boy culture and the girl culture, single-sex classrooms, which is a new buzz, no one asks the question, how is this advantage? Or they introduce the same people who mouth the fact that know, boys and girls are so different, they require this kind of learning. They don't ask the really piercing questions. You know, for example, why is it a good thing to have all boys and girls, all boy classes, all girl classes? Even if boys and girls learn differently, which there are no data to suggest they do, why wouldn't it be beneficial to have boys and girls in the same class where they can learn each other's styles of learning? The penetrating questions aren't asked. So I think until we get to a place like that, it's going to be a slog. But I think parents can, we know from other studies, if parents in their own environment can inoculate kids by showing them that if you're a girl, it's not a pigeonhole. The label girl can mean anything. You can be a girl and have all kinds of interests. You can have a girl and have all kinds of academic abilities. And the same thing about a boy. If you have a little boy, he has to learn that being a boy doesn't mean he can't have feelings. Of course he can have feelings. But you have to expand the definition so as a boy grows up, and there are critical periods when kids are starting to get an idea of what it means to be their gender, that you're sensitive to that and you expand that notion for a little boy. Oh, yes, you know, you like dress up. Well, boys like to do that. And it just start down deep, you know, at a level where kids, when they're older, see this stuff and they just write it off because they know it's not true.
Well, look at the messages kids are getting. Just look at the news headlines lately. You know, women are commodified. Women's bodies are commodified much more than men's. I mean, we do some of it with men. But look at what happened when Elizabeth Warren sort of made a joke when they asked her about what did she do during college. As opposed to Scott Brown, she sort of laughs, well, I didn't take my clothes off. And Scott Brown shot back with, well, good thing, or thank heaven, or something like that. And so I think young women look around and they see that essentially women disappear at about age 40 in terms of the media. And when women try to do different things, anybody remember Evelyn Murphy running for governor and all they talked about was her thighs? And Hillary Clinton had a modest décolletage in the Senate, and you would have thought that she'd come in wearing a bustier. So the message is for young women that the male gaze is always there, and they'd better look perfect, whether they're 15 and, you know, going out to junior high school, or whether they're 50 and running for the Senate. And I think this is a real, real problem.
So I just want to add something because we have a participant audience member who gave me something about the media. I just want to say that the media in some ways not only destroys women and girls' sense of self, it also repeats a kind of masculine image repeatedly that's still the male gaze, but it's purportedly through the woman, right? So this ad is from a Virginia Slims ad, and unfortunately I can't, it's not big enough for people to see, but it's two people sitting here watching a movie, clearly a sad movie, and the man looks like he's tearing up, and the woman's looking at him and saying, "We love a man who cries, just not more than we do." So the point is the ways in which the media reinforces a certain notion of manhood, womanhood, extended, and how detrimental that can be. I just have to say one thing, though. What is amazing to me after listening to so many kids after so many years is how much kids actually reject those messages, at least when they're younger. And then as they get older, they start to accommodate to them. But that, if we can only, as parents and teachers and people who work with kids, help them maintain their resistance to a damaging culture, that's what we should be seeking as professionals. And
probably
I know Rosin wants to jump in. If you have a question, if you could come to the microphone, that would be great. And so, Rosin, why don't you
very
one
quickly,
more comment?
In terms of Rick's question about what can people do about it, very recently, JCPenney was advertising some T-shirts, selling them. And one of the things said, homework is so difficult, I have to have my brother do it. And there were other kinds of messages that the women's groups actually got them to take those T-shirts off the shelves because they were so dangerous and so bad, or algebra is too hard for me, or something like that. And they now are no longer available for sale.
Did you want to say something quickly, Carol?
No, go ahead.
Okay, great. All right, so our first question, I will ask everyone to be brief just because there are several of you. So, and if you could introduce yourself, please.
My name's Richie. I noticed on the book, dust jacket of the Rivers Barnett book, it said that Carol Rivers received the Helen Thomas Lifetime Achievement Award. That sounds like something out of The Onion. Anybody who would accept such an award is highly questionable, to say the least. Well, now, I know your methods are to misrepresent other people and your enemies like Christine Hoff Sommers and Stephen Rhodes and others. It continues in this book with the Lawrence Summers matter, in which you claim that he apologized for his false science. He did no such thing. He apologized for offending folks like you who are too sensitive to have another point of view. So I want to ask you this. Are you in favor of people like Summers and people who hold different points of view than you being drummed out of the academy?
Excuse me, I'm going to have to stop. I'm going to have to stop you just because we have to be brief.
Okay, I'll respond briefly. Larry Summers didn't exactly get drummed out of the academy. He was appointed to a high position in the Obama administration. He's now back at Harvard. And he did actually talk to his women scientists at Harvard and did say that, yes, he did have much of the science wrong. As for the Helen Thomas Award, you're referring to the fact that Helen Thomas made a very insensitive remark about Israel. And I regret that she made that remark, but I really don't think that a lifetime of wonderful service and reporting has to be negated by one stupid remark that she made when she didn't even know she was on camera. It was a stupid mistake, but she still has been a wonderful journalist.
Okay. Yes, with respect to single-sex education, how do little girls feel and how do little boys feel about being educated all mixed together as opposed to separated? And is it important to take account of how these two different genders relate to that question at that age?
Well, first of all, I don't think anyone's really asked little kids what their preferences are, really little kids. When you get to middle school, they do ask kids. And a lot of times boys and girls will prefer to be in a mixed-sex environment. Doesn't mean that their parents put them in those environments. But they enjoy mixed-sex is the way people operate in the world. And I think that's one of the ways you can testimony to that is how many single-sex colleges, historical ones, have become co-ed because kids want to be educated with the opposite sex.
Okay, does that apply to elementary level as well?
They don't ask elementary kids what.
Why?
Why? Because I have to ask educators why they don't. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about single-sex and co-ed education is that, you know, in some sense, if we lived in a world that we would foster the humanity of girls and boys, right? If we would foster our own humanity, then there wouldn't, right? Single-sex schools wouldn't be necessary. The reason why we have single-sex schools, all girls schools, as well as all boys schools, is oftentimes what you find, even in all boys schools, actually there's a way in which they foster boys' humanity with each other much more so than in a co-ed education. That's not inherent to single-sex. That's living in a culture where we actually encourage kids to disconnect from what they know and disconnect from their relationships. We even define maturity that way, is to separate rather than to actually deeply connect. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very disruptive, dysfunctional larger context that then produces the need for single-sex education.
Yeah, I think some of the recent stuff suggests that in all-boy environments, there's actually more competition between boys than there is in co-ed environments. So I think it's an ongoing story, and the data aren't all in, but it's certainly not a clear picture that there's more humanity in the single-sex environments.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Caroline. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to the kind of tools that are available to, say, adult women to undo some of the thinking that we were taught when we were younger, especially when it comes to, like, being bigger risk takers, believing in yourself more, not feeling like you have to have so many skills before you can feel confident, things like that. In school, you can excel by being a people pleaser, you know, but when you get into the working world, you need to be a risk taker and all those things. Can you speak to some of the tools that are available to us today to be able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to respond, and I know that the two of them will also have comments. I mean, the thing that's so complicated is that I have a daughter and a son, and I do want to foster in my daughter her willingness to take risks, because that's why I'm here, is because I'm willing to take risks, and so I do want to foster that. But I also want to live in a culture that actually values the kind of skills that are associated with being a girl or being gay, which is basically relational skills. And knowing that my daughter's abilities to have good quality friendships and talk about her feelings is actually a real plus, and it will actually help her at work, right? It'll help her succeed in her job, and it'll help her sort of get the things she wants to get done. Taking risks, right, in the context of a quality relationship or a quality work atmosphere. So I want to do the other thing, is not only encourage girls, right, to take those risks, but also encourage a culture to value what what girls and women, how we've been socialized to be. So that doesn't really answer your question, but it's just a broader.
Well, I want to make a plug for the book that Carol and I did before this one that we're talking about today. So with a plug for that, the book is called Same Difference, and it is about the literature on adult men and women, and just the various things I think you're looking for. It writes in a very reader-friendly way about things like nurturance and communication and achievement and aggression, and how to understand the relationship between gender and all those constructs that are so stereotyped in our culture. And I think it will provide you with some helpful ammunition.
And by the way, we're looking at the workplace now, and what's interesting is that sometimes it's all put on the women. You've got to change, you've got to make yourself take risks, you've got to do stuff. But what we're finding is that when women do take risks at work, they don't get second chances. This is particularly true in the high-tech business, that when a guy does something risky and he fails, well, everybody says, oh, Joe, you'll do it the next time, dust yourself off. When a woman does it, she is toast. And the women realize, I can't fail. And that makes them, you know, stop and maybe not do the risky things that are going to move them up. So we have to not just work on people, we also have to work on people who run companies and who make the rules, to understand that the rules too often are very skewed against women.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Matthew, and actually I like a lot of what you're talking about and what you're saying, but I do have a question, and that question has to do with, is there a culture separate from American culture somewhere else where you actually find that there are very few sex distinctions made, or fewer, or perhaps reversals? If there is no actual genetic difference, you know, in terms of our brains, are there any cultures that demonstrate a reversal role where the men are the caretaker of the children and the women going out to, right. Have you done that study?
Okay, no. So I would just, you know, think about it. They can answer the question about other cultures if they have data on that. I would also say, though, all you need to do is look at this culture and go back 100 years to show that, in fact, like the notion of emotional sensitivity, of being emotional, linked to a sex and a sexuality, that's a late 20th century, early 21st century equation. That did not exist in 19th century. You see that, I mean, the emotional sensitivity was seen as a standard human quality. So the fact that we're now in a place which where we're not doing that reveals the culture in which we live in, which is that my favorite thing is that in 19th century, apparently, couples on their honeymoon would take their best friend, their best
what?
Friends. To me, that reveals everything about our culture. We would never take our best friends on our honeymoons. But in the 19th century, that was actually a fairly common thing to do. So the whole notion is that we need multiple relationships, not just a spouse. So it's relating to your question, but it's through time rather than through context.
And I'd like to just address it and get in this culture, because I think it's some relevant data. If you take families today in our culture, where for some reason or another the wife is not present, she either deserted the family or she died, and the father, who was not the original primary caretaker of the children, takes over. And you look at those men over time, they are indistinguishable in terms of their parenting behavior from mothers who are in two or under families. And there are a lot of books, I can give you some references, of showing how men's child-rearing, parenting behavior, it's a learned thing, as it is for women. Women aren't born knowing how to be a mother. And they learn that, and they learn it just as well as women do. When the circumstances require, in our culture, the circumstances usually don't require men to be at home, and you can argue why, you know, why we have this kind of a norm for the ideal worker, but we do. But there's certainly the variability, and you can have a very dramatic changes in male behavior as a function of changes in circumstances.
Okay, you still didn't answer the question about other cultures.
Well, it's a bit too complicated because the issues are power, access to jobs and money. So every culture is different. Usually men have been the power brokers in every culture. It dictates the rules of who can get into certain occupations, dictates a lot. So it's very hard. If you want to talk individually, we can talk about it separately, about various cultures.
Okay.
But
well,
it's a bigger
we can
issue.
Talk about it. I think in Scandinavia, when they... They expanded paternity leave, and they said basically, men, if you don't lose it, if you don't use it, you lose it. And what happened was that really did change men's parenting behavior. So we did see that in Scandinavian countries, men are doing much more parenting because they're getting time off for it. So yes, we don't have that. So men don't have the chance to have that advantage.
I would just say something quickly about this. I mean, I forgot exactly what dimension you were interested in, but certainly in terms of things like expressions of vulnerability and expressions of intimacy, it varies enormously across culture.
Yeah.
But I would also say that even though that's true, that doesn't mean that biology doesn't matter. I think there is an enormously complex interplay between biology and social influence here that's important to look at.
Oops.
Sorry, thank you.
Excellent.
How do you integrate like temperament? Because you talk, for example, you talk about rough and tumble play, and that's what boys do. But I found with my children, there's a temperamental difference. Say there are kids, girls or boys, who love rough and tumble play, and then there are kids who don't. Or in sports, there are children who just are horrified by contact sports, and then there's others who thrive on it in both sexes. And so it seems to me that somehow you labeled certain temperaments as either male or female, whereas, well, how do you actually integrate variations in temperament, which are, you know, there's a great deal of variation in temperament.
I think what you're suggesting is that one of the points in our book is that it's much more important to look at the individual child than it is to worry about their gender. So some kids, boys or girls, might be more active, more physically aggressive. And that's, you have to take into account the temperament, the child's proclivity, rather than what their gender is, and treat them that way.
Other thoughts about this one?
Well, I think that we've just got to stop putting kids in boxes. Mm-hmm. You know, we have this thing of, there's these pink and blue boxes and it explains everything. We used to have black and white boxes and say that race explained everything. And again, what we really have to do, and it's hard because, you know, we have dwindling resources, but, you know, schools have to look at children as individuals and not as, you know, members of groups, because it doesn't really work for all kids then.
So we have about 3 or 4 minutes, and maybe we can get both questions in if everyone is quick. Go ahead.
Okay, my name's Matt. My general impression so far has been that you oppose the single-sex education system. How would you refute such claims that a single-sex system reduces teenage pregnancies, reduces the need for discipline between students, allows boys, for instance, to take classes like drama and acting that would normally have like a stigma attached to girls on it? Aren't those benefits that are?
Yeah, I think we may disagree on the single-sex thing, but I don't think so. I think that the wrong route would be to go down to say that there's no benefits of single sex or there's no benefits of co-ed education. That would be totally problematic. The reality is there's some superb single sex schools that really allow boys to be boys in all their humanity, meaning, right, taking drama classes, et cetera. And there are girls schools that allow girls to actually thrive and to taking risks, et cetera. However, we still live in a culture in which oftentimes in a co-ed education or in the larger culture, we don't actually foster that. So the question for me is, how do you build schools that foster kids' humanity? You know, and whether, right, and ideally, yes, I do agree with them that it would be in a co-ed context, but I don't think that anybody wants to go to the round of saying that there's no good single-sex schools, because that would just be not, right, that disrupts. People who went to single-sex schools and had a good experience, it obviously contradicts.
Yeah, and we don't
point.
Say
that's not our argument. We don't make that point.
We don't make it. We only argue about the great expansion of single-sex schools in public schools. They're terrific private single-sex schools.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm being signaled that we do have to wind this up. My apologies to you. I'm sure these guys could hang around a little bit if you want to. So let me just say two things. One is, we are hoping, I think you have a survey, and we're hoping that you will take a minute to fill out the survey. And also, importantly, all the way across the hall, in the room across the hall, there are books. I'm really making a pitch for buying these books, and these guys are going to be over there to sign them. Thank you all.
Thank you.
So you're kidding. How great to meet you. Have we talked on the phone? Probably have. You must have talked on the phone.
Oh, yeah.
Say again?
Awesome. It was so good.